Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present EPA Senior Policy Analyst and Whistleblower Hugh Kaufman, who explains why he believes that the EPA is now involved in a cover-up of the health hazards present in BP's Gulf of Mexico oil spill. Author Catherine Murphy, who lived in Cuba during the 1990s, describes the island nation's shift to organic, sustainable agriculture after the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991. And Carol Scagnetti, board president of the group Marriage Equality USA, who reacts to the recent federal district court decision that declared California's Proposition 8 banning gay marriage unconstitutional. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Afghan President Hamid Karzai has issued a decree ordering all private security firms to be disbanded by the end of the year. By that time, thousands of security contractors working in Afghanistan must join the Afghan police force or cease operations within 4 months. The one exception is for private security firms hired by international groups such as embassies or NGOs, which are required to remain within their compounds and be registered with the Interior Ministry. Karzai stated in his November 2009 inaugural speech that he would put an end to both foreign and domestic security companies by November 2011. The recent decree clearly expedites the deadline. The U.S. warned that such rapid withdrawal would be impossible to complete by the deadline and may slow down reconstruction and development. NATO commanders rely heavily on both foreign and Afghan security contractors to protect bases and convoys. According to the Associated Press, the U.S. claims the Afghan Interior Ministry currently licenses 52 security companies, a small fraction of the 30,000 security contractors working in the country. There have been an increasing number of complaints that private security firms, including Blackwater, aren't well regulated and operate in a manner that endangers the civilian population. Karzai spokesman Wahid Omar said, "It's not about regulating their activities. They have developed into alternative forces. The security companies have to go." United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon emerged in May 2006 as the leading candidate to run the UN during a meeting of the Council of Foreign Relations. During a question-and-answer session, the low-key South Korean bureaucrat was coy and displayed little energy for driving the UN forward. Today, Ban is two-thirds of the way through his first term, with few accomplishments to show for his effort. According to Foreign Policy magazine, the world superpowers, including the Bush administration, selected Ban to avoid a repeat of the previous UN Secretary General Kofi Annan's uncomfortable opposition to the 2003 U.S.-Iraq invasion and his involvement in Iraq's oil for food program scandal. Last August, a memo from Norwegian diplomat Mona Juul leaked to the press accusing the Secretary General of being spineless and charmless in human rights emergencies like Myanmar and Sri Lanka. Inga Britt Elenius, the outgoing head of the UN's Office of Internal Oversight Services, which investigates alleged wrongdoings of UN bodies, charges that Ban has failed to drive his own reform agenda, which he has largely entrusted to a marginal player, Deputy Secretary General Asha Rose Majiro. She also alleges he has concentrated power inside a tiny circle of advisors, has issued edicts rather than seeking to gain consensus, and treats dissent as disloyalty. The growing debate over building a mosque and community center near the site of the terrorist attacks at Ground Zero in Lower Manhattan has launched a multi-city bus ad campaign claiming to offer refuge to former Muslims. Bus ads questioning Islam are running in San Francisco, New York City, and Miami. The ads are sponsored by the group Stop Islamization of America, run by conservative blogger Pamela Geller. According to the Christian Science Monitor, her aim is to help ex-Muslims who get in trouble. Geller claims she started the campaign in response to a Florida teenage girl who ran away from her Muslim parents after converting to Christianity. Rifka Barry made headlines last year after she claimed her father threatened to kill her for becoming a Christian. Detroit, the city with the highest concentrations of Muslims in the U.S., refused to run the bus ads, and Geller sued the Detroit Transit Agency. She claims a controversial campaign, sponsored by a group of atheists last year, ran on buses and billboards in many cities and read, "Don't believe in God, you're not alone." Although offensive to some, the ads were deemed free speech. In Florida, the Miami-Dade Transit Agency initially pulled the ads, but reinstated them when threatened with a potential lawsuit. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Although crude oil stopped gushing from British Petroleum's blown-out Deepwater Horizon oil well after a custom metal cap was finally lowered on top of the damaged wellhead a mile under the Gulf of Mexico on July 15th, a permanent fix has still not been carried out. Government officials say further pressure tests and risk assessment will be necessary before the well is permanently killed through the injection of mud and concrete via a relief well. During the 86 days of the BP spill, some 4.9 million barrels of oil poured into the Gulf of Mexico in the nation's worst environmental disaster. A report released by Georgia's Sea Grant College Program and the University of Georgia concludes that up to 79% of the oil released into the Gulf of Mexico has not been recovered and remains a threat to the ecosystem, contradicting a National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration report that claimed only 25% of the oil remained in the Gulf. Apart from billions of dollars lost in regional tourism and the seafood industry, the long-term effects of the oil and chemical dispersant on human and marine life are unknown. Hugh Kaufman, senior policy analyst at the Environmental Protection Agency's Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response, blew the whistle on EPA and OSHA's cover-up of the environmental health effects on first responders at the World Trade Center site in New York City after the 9/11 attacks. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Hugh Kaufman, who explains why he believes that the EPA is now involved in a similar cover-up of the hazards present in the BP oil spill.
Well, I mean, my perception is, unfortunately, that the response to this has been similar to the 9/11 case, where they tried to, both BP and the government, downplay the impact of this. And frankly, there were a lot of false statements being made and continue to be made about how much oil and contaminated material is even left. I mean, you've heard some of the press statements that only 25% is left. Yet when you look deeper into the statistics, you find that even the scientists whose statistics they use think there's more like 75% of the oil and contaminants still down there.
Hugh Kaufman, I've read a quote that you felt that the Environmental Protection Agency that you work with and the National Oceanic and Atmosphere Administration, NOAA, were really sock puppets for British Petroleum in covering up the toxicity of this oil dispersant called Corexit. You want to explain to our listeners a little bit about what you meant there?
Well, sure. I mean, the problem that was, it was not just me, I just happened to be a whistleblower, whereas other people in the system are a little bit more nervous. I'm almost 70 years old, so I can retire down the line. But most of the technical people inside are very disappointed that EPA and NOAA, in fact, has been doing what's in the best interest of BP in terms of these toxic dispersants, as opposed to what's in the best interest of the environment and the public. Now, let me explain. These are hazardous materials that were being pumped into the water at a mile down, as well as being carpet bombed over the area to try to make the oil disappear under the surface. By doing that, you're increasing the toxic reaction to the oil that's being atomized into droplets by the dispersants, as well as increasing toxicity with the dispersant oil mix, that will have a very adverse effect on marine life underneath the surface, but will make it look on the surface like there's, in fact, less oil. And that's what BP wanted. BP wanted the optics of less oil on the surface so that they could try to hide the volume of oil that has, in fact, gushered up, which will save them billions of dollars in fines and penalties. and will make it almost impossible to clean up the area in a timely fashion. Let me explain. In the case of the Amoco Cadiz oil spill, which was a very big spill back in 1978 off the coast of France, some of that oil was dispersed and some of it was allowed to be broken up, weathered, if you will, by natural forces. The oil that was not dispersed with dispersants started breaking up, and it's pretty much all been resolved within 5 years, back in the 80s. But the oil where dispersants were used to atomize the oil, that oil has still not been eaten by the microbes. And so to this day, over 30 years later, that oil is still presenting a problem in that area that the oil spill occurred. So you're going to have the same problem in the Gulf of Mexico because they use so many dispersants down there. It's going to take a lot longer for that oil to be broken down by natural processes as opposed to if they hadn't used the dispersants.
Hugh, what about the seafood industry in the Gulf of Mexico? I know there's a lot of testing we hear about now of the seafood stocks and to see what's safe and how soon the fishermen can get back into making a living off their trade. They're catching shrimp and other fish that they sell across the country. What's your understanding of the situation there right now?
Well, first of all, there's been so much misinformation put out there about the seafood being safe, and that, for example, just the other day I heard government people making the statement that they haven't found any contaminated fish. Nobody buys that, certainly not even the fishermen buy that. In sworn testimony to Congress that there's no dispersants in the fish that they've tested. And then with a follow-up question for a United States senator, they have to admit, no, we haven't tested the fish for dispersants. So until such time as the government can get more realistic and be honest with the people, I think the public is not going to believe anything that the government says, and the fishermen don't believe it either. In fact, evidence comes up all the time that there is a serious contamination in the water, and there's a lot of fish in the water. And no one believes that fish can swim and breathe in that contamination and not be contaminated. Certainly, experienced doctors in the field don't believe it. Neither do most marine biologists.
That was Hugh Kaufman, senior policy analyst with the Environmental Protection Agency. He was chief investigator on many contamination cases, including Love Canal and Times Beach, and was the originator of EPA's Toxic Cleanup Superfund program. With the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991 and the end of the Cold War, Cuba witnessed the collapse of its highly subsidized economy. Particularly hard hit was Cuba's export sugar crop, which had for decades been purchased by Russia and East Germany at artificially high prices. The large shipments of wheat and rice that the government of Fidel Castro had received from the Eastern Bloc soon stopped arriving at Cuban ports. With the U.S. economic embargo preventing agricultural trade with the island nation's closest neighbor, Cuba was faced with an economic crisis like no other since its 1959 revolution. The difficult years after the fall of the Soviet Union are known as the Special Period, when Cuba was forced to wean itself off its highly mechanized and oil-dependent agricultural sector. The keynote speaker at this year's Northeast Organic Farming Conference, held August 13th through the 15th at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, was Catherine Murphy, who lived in Cuba in the 1990s during the nation's economic crisis and transition in agricultural production. She has spent the better part of the past two decades documenting Cuba's shift to organic, sustainable agriculture. Murphy was a last-minute replacement at the NOFA conference for Fernando Funes, known as the father of the Cuban organic agriculture movement. The following is an excerpt of Catherine Murphy's keynote address.
Cuba was in a moment of tremendous crisis. Immediate food intake dropped drastically, and Cuba went from being one of the countries in Latin America with the highest food, per capita food intake in the 80s to being among the lowest. And they developed, there were a number of pathologies that developed because of this rapid drop in food intake, including an eye neuropathy problem that about 40,000 people were affected with that include temporary blindness that was seen to be related to the rapid drop in B vitamin intake. And right at this time, the U.S. economic embargo, which had been in place since the early 60s, was actually tightened under what was known as the Torricelli Act or the Cuban Democracy Act. They outlawed trade by foreign subsidiaries of U.S. companies with Cuba, and most of this trade had been in food and medicine. It's actually illegal under international law because subsidiaries are supposed to follow the laws of the country in which they reside, but these subsidiaries, if they were found to trade with Cuba, their trading with the home company would be cut off, and few subsidiaries really could afford to do that. It cost Cuba food imports at a time that they were very critical. So, in the words of Fernando Funes, at that moment, he said Cuba had two choices. They could either lay down and die, or they could stand up and fight. Stand up and do something, which is what they did. They stood up. They stood up and they embarked upon what would become the largest conversion from chemical industrial agriculture to a low-input, sustainable, agroecologically based organic and semi-organic food production system ever known. This was begun 20 years ago. They've been on that path ever since with a very, very strong commitment, certainly with some internal debate, but they've been making consistent headway. They also really work to decentralize agricultural production, breaking the large state farms, most of the large state farms, into worker cooperatives. And the workers then became cooperative owners of everything from the ground up. The buildings, the homes, the storage shed, the silos, the tractors, the vehicles, and also their own produce, of which they sell the bulk on an annual contracts to the state, and any excess they can sell at farmers markets, private farmers markets that were also reestablished in the early 90s as a way to bridge the producer-consumer gap that was so critical at that period, and they've remained. Another part of the decentralization, I think it's important to say, is that they didn't just change the ownership structure or the organization of these farms, but they, in terms of producing, broke them up into smaller units. So rather than being 300 people farming an enormous, huge piece of land, they would break the land up in sometimes 100 or 150 subplots, and smaller groups of people would be responsible for the subplots and diversify the planting. They started doing a lot of intercropping, companion planting, crop rotations, working with green manures, working with animal manures for soil improvement. And they also do really interesting work in worm composting and worm culture. There are numerous lessons for us in Cuba's survival of the crisis in general, in food and agriculture in particular. Clearly, some of the lessons would be that a large-scale conversion from industrial agriculture to organic agriculture is absolutely possible. The importance and the power of strategically supporting farmers and producers, I think, is a huge lesson that we get from Cuba, that we can grow more with less, that we can live with less, and we can actually lead happier, richer, more fulfilling lives if we start to think less in terms of I and more in terms of we, and we may actually be able to save ourselves and our species and the planet in the process. So thank you very much.
That was Catherine Murphy, author of the book Cultivating Havana. She is a fellow at Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy, and has led a number of the group's agricultural tours to Cuba. Contact Food First at area code 510-654-5000. 4400 or visit their website at foodfirst.org. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Federal District Court Judge Vaughn Walker's August 4th decision, which declared California's Proposition 8 banning gay marriage unconstitutional, has revived an emotional nationwide debate on the future of gay marriage across the country. Proposition 8 passed by a 52-48% margin in a November 2008 California statewide ballot, outlaws gay marriage by amending the state constitution, overturning a May 2008 California Supreme Court ruling that found same-sex couples have a right to marry. In his August 4th ruling overturning Proposition 8, Judge Walker wrote, "Proposition 8 fails to advance any rational basis in singling out gay men and lesbians for denial of a marriage license. Indeed, the evidence shows Proposition 8 does nothing more than enshrine in the California Constitution the notion that opposite-sex couples are superior to same-sex couples." The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit extended a stay on Judge Walker's ruling, which means marriage licenses will not be issued to California's gay couples until after the appeals court itself rules on the constitutionality of Proposition 8. Most observers believe the case will ultimately be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Carol Scagnetti, board president of the group Marriage Equality USA, who reacts to the recent court decisions and the uncertainty over the future of gay marriage.
You know, from a human perspective, my reaction to Judge Walker's decision was I was pretty elated. You know, we've been through so many decisions in the past 5 years, court decisions, elected officials' decisions, and so forth, that, you know, I've almost become sometimes a little bit desensitized to whether the decision is for us or against us, because we know that there'll still be more work to do. But Judge Walker's decision was particularly important because, number one, there was evidence produced at this trial, mountains of evidence from people, from experts, from gay folks, from supporters, mayor of San Diego. Many people really established the fact that there's really no difference. Marriage is marriage between two people who are committed. And it also established the fact that this Proposition 8 and all the other anti-LGBT marriage initiatives and ballot measures across the country are really established because a group of people don't like it, and they're angry, and they have some animus toward gay people based on old stereotypes and prejudices. That became so evident that this decision was, to my thinking and to my feelings, very, very important, because anyone who reads this decision sees how carefully he lays out all of these facts and all of these arguments and essentially pulls the rug out from under each and every argument.
You know, one of the things that people have been talking about since David Boies and Ted Olson brought this case was that, in your mind, is there some uncalculable risk here that the Supreme Court, a fairly conservative Supreme Court, could eventually rule against gay marriage and allow these state referendums and other initiatives to ban gay marriage state to state stand? Is this something that concerns you, that this could be a coin toss of some type that could set back the movement for gay marriage by decades?
Well, yeah, you said it perfectly. It is an incalculable risk. We can not predict what the Supreme Court will do, but nor can the other side. And I think they are as much at risk, and realizing that they are as much at risk right now as we are. We don't know how one or two people on the court will decide, and we can't predict that. And it is, but for years people have said, go slowly, it's too scary, we don't know what will happen. But, you know, at some point you have to say, all right, we're jumping into the pool. So I think that there is reluctance. I think there's concern and fear. And it has been an incremental step-by-step movement for so many years that the decision of when is the big step the right time is one that's discussed at length all over blogs and so forth. And there, I don't think there's a right answer, but when you have two of the most prominent, both, you know, Democratic and Republican attorneys in the country bringing this case, I think it says somebody thinks it's time.
So you have confidence in David Boies and Ted Olson, who initiated this case, and if all things work out as they hope, they'll be arguing this case in front of the Supreme Court.
I think, as they hope, they will be, and I'm not sure how I feel about that. There's pros and cons to how this case could come out. From a selfish standpoint, you know, maybe we say, wouldn't it be nice if there was a very narrow ruling and we just got marriage back in California and there would be another state that has legal marriage and another step closer to winning in the Supreme Court. That's one view. It's a feeling of safety and a better feeling than taking a huge risk.
What do you make of the argument of proponents of Proposition 8 that Judge Walker's decision overturn the will of the people, that somehow that's sacrosanct and should not be messed with by the judiciary branch of government, that this particular referendum, which won, should be honored? What's your view on that?
You know, I think the populace doesn't get to vote on who has access to fundamental rights. And, you know, that's a fundamental principle of our country's government and of our Constitution. We don't put rights up to a vote, I think, as Ted Olson said on CNN. I mean, would we put free speech up to a vote? What if we passed a law? What if 52% of the people in California passed a law that no one could have a gun in this state, including a hunting firearm? I think there'd be a huge outcry from some of the same people who have an outcry about our rights being decided by a judge.
That was Carol Scagnetti, board president of the group Marriage Equality USA. Contact the group by calling area code 510-496-2700 or visit their website at marriageequality.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.